Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Filmcast, a podcast about movies. I'm David Chen, and there's only two times I don't want to mess with Mads Mikkelsen: when he's trying to grow stuff in the Danish Heath, and when he's cutting a hole in a chair. Joining me today is Devinder Hardawar.
As far as I can remember, I always wanted to be a farmer.
And Jeff Cannata.
Sometimes you can get both Mads and even.
Oh, nice.
Those are, of course, all vague and oblique references to the fact that today on the podcast, we're going to be reviewing the 2023 film, The Promised Land, which just was released on video on demand. We've been hearing great things about it online from a bunch of critics and other folks in the industry. So we thought, hey, Dune 2 is the main event for this month. Let's take it easy a little bit. Check out The Promised Land. A lot to discuss there. You can find more episodes of this podcast at thefilmcast.com. Email us at /filmcast@gmail.com. And find us on Instagram and Threads at The Filmcast Pod, on YouTube at The Filmcast Pod. We're also on TikTok at The Filmcast. Today on the podcast, we're going to be talking about the 96th Annual Academy Awards, which just aired as we're recording this last night. Talk about what we thought about the broadcast as well as some of the awards. We got some what we've been watching for you, and then some weekly plugs before getting to our review of The Promised Land. So let's get to it, folks. Before we begin today, I just want to mention, folks, in the time since our last podcast recording, I have seen Dune Part 2 two additional times in IMAX and in the at the Pacific Science Center, which
amazing,
which kind of projects the movie at 1.43 by 1 aspect ratio. About 40 minutes of the movie was shot at 1.43 by 1 aspect ratio. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, it looks amazing. If you have the opportunity to see it in that aspect ratio, you should check it out. There's a lot of speculation online about whether anything was actually specifically shot for that format or whether they just kind of cropped the 1.9 mm-hmm. by 1 aspect ratio into the 1.43 option. I think we'll have to wait a little bit to see like side by side to compare. But anyway, incredible experience. Just wanted to shout that out. And I think Dune 2 is going to go all the way, guys. Next year's Oscars, already a front runner. Speaking of Oscars, last night we had the Oscars broadcast, and I just want to start by saying, you know, there is this episode of The Simpsons where Homer becomes an astronaut. And mm-hmm. Bart Pretty Simpson forget. Says, hey, like, I'm experiencing this, like, unknown feeling. What's the opposite of shame? And she's in, you know, Mart says pride. And he says, no, it's not that far from shame. And then Homer says less shame. And he's like, yep, that's right. You know, I think the Oscars have been kind of a clown car crash ongoing for the last few years. There have been slaps and misopened envelopes and all this stuff. And last mm-hmm. night, delivered a Oscars broadcast that was just fine. It was perfectly
John
acceptable.
Mulaney was the inanimate carbon rod, right? John Mulaney kind of held it all together with his bit.
I thought it was actually a overall pretty mm-hmm. enjoyable evening. Devinder, I know you watched a bunch of it as well. What did you think of the Oscars?
Oh, I missed the very beginning, but I liked what I saw. Like, I think all the bits with the various guests, the bits were very good. If anything, the big takeaway is that John Mulaney was there for a little bit, and I think all of us were asking, why can't he just stay? Can mm-hmm, he just stick around? Yeah. Can we just have like a Mulaney-led Oscars, which is a thing people have been talking about for years? So there's that. I have some things to say about like some speeches people have done. And this was like overall a very international Oscars too. Like a lot of films not from the U.S. winning big awards. And that's pretty huge, I'd say.
Yeah, love John Mulaney. He's clearly someone that loves movies and is a movie nerd, yes. right? And that definitely yes. comes through.
I don't know if he wrote the joke about Madame Web, but he certainly delivered it perfectly. You know,
Madame Web got kind of dragged a bunch last night. It's already a punchline in Hollywood, it seems, which is kind of sad for the people who worked on that film. But yeah, be sure to check out our review of that movie. It was, in my opinion, very enjoyable to watch. But a few other highlights of the evening for me, you know, just like when I think back on the night, like some stuff that sticks up about the broadcast. First of all, Ryan Gosling performing I'm Just Ken, I thought was so joyful and exuberant. Just like a really
so good.
you know, I'm not used to feeling those things when I'm watching the Oscars, but it's just like, wow, this is a blast. Ryan Gosling,
pretty good. Good choreography. Yeah. A lot of the supporting cast coming back to do the sequence with him.
Yeah. So. That was lovely.
Good stuff. And, I will say, can we put a pause on that song for a while now? Can that just be it? Can that be the moratorium on I'm Just Ken? Because I'm also tired of hearing it. So that's just me.
And then, you know, we'll talk a little bit more about the award specifically, but I just wanted to mention also Godzilla Minus One was nominated for one Academy Award, Best Visual Effects, an award in a category in which it won. And that was amazing. But the thing I just want to mention is everyone in that crew was so cute. They all had like Godzilla tchotchkes and merch. Shoes? Like they were wearing Godzilla shoes. And
the shoes are great. They got to sell the shoes, please.
It's just rare to see people at the Oscars geeking out about the thing that they're in, like in a very like earnest and kind of quasi cheesy way.
Sure. Well, I mean, when you invite nerds, when you nominate nerds, this is what happens.
Yeah.
That's ultimately it.
Yeah, indeed. But yeah, I thought that was lovely. All right. So just a couple of things I wanted to hit in terms of the broadcast itself, but let's talk about the awards. Oppenheimer, the big winner of the night, 7 Academy Awards. I think the most that has ever been won by any movie in one night is Slumdog Millionaire with 8, if I'm not mistaken. So it's definitely up there. And it won most of the major categories, including Best Picture, Best Director. It was honestly great to see Christopher Nolan get an Oscar. I think that is long overdue, very well deserved. This guy is helping to keep theatrical film going alive. Jeff Cannata, were there any kind of awards that you saw last night that you really appreciated movies getting recognition?
I was glad to see that Anatomy of the Fall won at least for screenplay. I was pleased by that. It was my favorite movie of the year. It was nice to see Miyazaki get an Academy Award at the end of his career. I don't think any of us had Oppenheimer on our top 10.
No. I remember being very tortured about that too, because like, I know this movie's going to crush. I know this movie's going to win awards, it's going to sweep the Oscars probably. But my heart and my soul was just like, I wish I liked it more. That's really all I can say about it. Yeah.
I agree. It's not one of those years where I'm outraged, which happens periodically,
right? Yeah,
where I'm like, it hurts me that this movie is getting all the awards, but this is not the case with Oppenheimer. I think Oppenheimer is a worthy entrant into the pantheon of Best Picture winners.
Yeah,
I don't think it is. I don't think its number of wins is commensurate with its distance from the rest of the pack. If you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a strange movie though, right? Because it's also this weird esoteric thing, but it's also a blockbuster. Like it got a lot of money at the box office too.
Well, the gift to the Academy, where it is awards bait in the way that they enjoy, but it also isn't shunning commercial success. They had a chance to lavish this thing with rewards because it both brought in the dollars and makes them feel good about the art form. So it's a rare bird in that way. I don't think we get many of those. So I think that, you know, it is perfectly suited for this year, what the Academy wanted, what it needed. But I don't know. I wish the love had been spread a bit more.
I agree. I think Killers of the Flower Moon was like kind of just shut out entirely.
It got completely shut out. Shame. It didn't win any awards. And also Barbie, most financially successful movie of the year, only won one for best original song. I think it's a testament, you know, Jeff, you're talking about how you wish the love had been spread out more. I think it's a testament to just, this is a very stacked year. Mm-hmm. And most of the movies in most of the categories were very good, I would argue. And that's awesome. So, you know, we should celebrate that. But as a result, some movies don't get as much recognition as other people are hoping. Poor Things did win for several below the line categories, including best production.
Best actress is above the line.
Yeah. No, and Best Actress. I was going to get to that, but yeah, it did win, I think, 4 Oscars total, including Best Actress. So, that was another kind of big winner of the night. Poor Things, kind of a relatively small film from Fox Searchlight, was able to take a bunch of these small prizes. I do want to highlight The Zone of Interest won for a couple of big awards, Best International Film and also Best Sound. And it beat
best
out
sound, seriously.
Oppenheimer mm-hmm. for Best Sound. And the sound in both of those movies is really incredible. But mm-hmm. The Zone of Interest uses sound in a way that no other movie that year uses sound, right?
It's sort of like...
Yeah, go ahead.
Jonathan Glazer's thing, right? Like he is almost like an alien looking at humanity, right? And looking at our species. And I think what was it? His previous film really captured that really well.
You think Under the Skin or
Under the Skin? Like he is just such a unique voice, I guess. And so yeah, the sound design of Zone of Interest is certainly a big one. And yeah, I have thoughts on his speech.
There's that old adage about the Academy Awards that you can replace the word best with the word most, and it will mm-hmm. better describe why it won, you know? So most sound is...
I know you don't like that movie, Jeff.
I do not. I do not like that movie.
You, in fact, hate that movie.
I do indeed hate that movie.
But you know, I would argue that doesn't apply. I think Oppenheimer had the most sound, in my opinion. But
literally the most sound, like an explosion on our against our ears. Yes.
Yeah.
I think most in this case meaning most
elaborate.
Most,
perhaps you know, I could say elaborate.
Well, most tied to its, you know,
most insisting
its essence. You know, it's like what you come out of that movie talking about is the sound, and I think that's. You know, I'm sure it's well deserved. I mean, I'm not saying it's not deserved. I did not care for that movie, but I think that's in the same way that Poor Things, another movie I absolutely loved and I think is completely worthy in this category, but that statement I think can apply to costume design, right? Poor Things has most costume design, right?
Mm-hmm. It had the most actress too. Like,
yes, exactly. Most acting in that category. Yeah. And I don't mean that as negative as it maybe is coming across. I just think it's a fun observation to make.
While we're talking about Zone of Interest, by the way, I do want to shout out Jonathan Glazer, just the king of this stuff. Like he took his chance at the speech to basically speak about what the movie is saying and being like, hey, this is not just a look into the past. This is a reflection of us right now. There's a genocide happening, you know, in Gaza against Palestinians. And he called that out directly and nobody else did. So that's something. In fact, there was a movie that won that was literally just against war, right? Was it the live action short? I missed the name of that here. It just felt like a weird thing that was happening, you know, right now that nobody's really talking about. People were talking about traffic in front of the ceremony, but it was all protesters, you know, calling for a ceasefire. So,
yeah, hey, the weird thing. I guess at one point they had literally on the screen, evil wins when good people do nothing.
They do
quote.
Have that. They did have that.
It's like, hello, is irony dead? Is do we not understand what is literally happening right now in this moment? Pretty amazing.
Anyway, shout out to Jonathan Glazer. His speech, everybody else's speech, every other like award acceptance is on the Academy's YouTube channel right now, but his is not.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Couple of other things to mention about the evening. I wanted to give a shout out to the best documentary winner, 20 Days in Mariupol. I thought that was also a very powerful speech. The first Ukrainian Oscar ever, but the director of that pointed out how like he wished it didn't have to come at the enormous cost at which it came. You know, he would have traded it in for not having to document the horrible things that he saw. And so another very powerful moment as well there. On a lighter note, Davine Joy Randolph won for Best Supporting Actress. There was a cool thing where they had other best actor winners of previous years come and personally present the award to the nominee, or personally kind of shout out the nomination on stage.
Just to create a moment where everybody was confused when they walked on stage as to who to talk to first, who to approach, what, how
yep,
to,
yep, yep.
Know, it just created chaos on stage, but you know, lovely idea.
Yeah. I saw a lot of people complaining like, oh, just show the clips. You know, we don't need to see people kind of inauthentically talk. But when they did it for Best Supporting Actress, it seemed like every one of those people knew each one of the nominees. And so that was kind of nice. That was like a cool thing. But then as the night went on, it became clear that that wasn't the case for the other nominees. So yeah, I don't know that it was entirely successful, but it's a cool idea. It's a cool idea. Anything else to mention about the evening? The Last Repair Shop won for best short film documentary, which I thought was really great. And it is available. It's cool that a lot of these are like available to watch right now. So I would strongly recommend it. It's a look at how important music is to the lives of students. And I was deeply moved by it. You should check that out. It's the, again, The Last Repair Shop. Yeah. Any other moments or nominees that folks want to mention?
Cena once again, proving he will just give his all, you know,
absolutely.
Which we'll talk about in a bit too.
Yeah, absolutely. Love John Cena presenting the award for best costume while seemingly wearing nothing. That was pretty,
Very bold. Tastefully placed nude stickers on his rear and groin, and then they dressed him in a robe in like 5 seconds. That was cool too.
Yeah. yeah, good stuff.
That was the whole thing.
I will say, but I think you're thinking of War is Over, the animated short film, Devendra Hardwar. That
War
you mentioned
is over.
Earlier.
Yes,
yeah, that's the one you mentioned. Yeah, I wanted to find that. Okay,
War is not over. In fact, yeah.
The one thing that was very odd was Al Pacino's announcement of Best Picture at the end of the night. I don't know if you guys saw
this. He just wanted to go home, guys. We all just wanted to go home.
I saw some speculation about this on Blue Sky this morning that made me buy like what happened. So for those who didn't watch it, he kind of wandered on stage, didn't really seem like he knew what he was saying, and then anticlimactically said, I guess I got to read the winner. You know, okay. The envelope tells
my
me to say
see.
That my eyes see Oppenheimer. And it was kind of like this very awkward moment of like, does this guy even know what he's doing? And the other weird thing is that most of the times when this is done, you go over who the nominees are one last time. Like throughout the whole night, we've been going through all the nominees. Yes. And then when the envelope is read, you go over all the nominees one more time. And I think what probably happened was he was supposed to say a sequence of words exactly that was supposed to trigger the nominees being shown in a video clip, right? And he didn't say that sequence of words for whatever variety of reasons. He didn't feel like he had to come to rehearsal because he's Al Pacino. You know, he forgot to, you know, like whatever sort of reason. And so he didn't say the words, and then they didn't play the clip. And then so he just ended up awkwardly reading that Oppenheimer is the best picture. But I thought that was a very weird.
My understanding was that the sequence of words that he was supposed to say were, it's got a great ass.
I think it's actually, he's got a great cast, Jeff. It's got a great cast. Oppenheimer. Anyway, at the end of the night, a lot of great films and great filmmakers got some well-deserved awards, and the show overall was not a travesty. So
it did end pretty early. I'm normally ready to like go until like 11 p.m. Eastern, right? Or even after to see everything. And this thing was done by 10:30 p.m. Eastern. We were just like out of there. There were
I hope
arguments
they do that again, first
many...
of all. Like that's awesome. They should do that every year, in my opinion.
And
all
and
combined with the daylight savings time, it was like, wow, this feels like the Oscars is starting like right after lunch, which is kind of odd.
It's true. Anyway, it's true. It felt like super zippy. There are a lot of arguments for a stunt Oscar, something highlighting stunt performers. And it seems like, hey, we got time. Seems like we got room. I think we should be doing that. So I do hope that's something we see more on the actual, you know, the televised Oscars at some point.
I 100% agree with that. It's very odd that there is going to be a best casting Oscar next year, but no best stunt. There was Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling introducing a clip package about stunts, but that was only really to promote their new movie, Fall Guy, which is coming
about
out
a stuntman.
About a stuntman, yeah.
Which looks like a lot of fun, by the way. That was like a fun little pre-trailer moment, I guess, or something, or pre-release moment for them.
Yeah, it was nice. So, but yeah, I hope that Best Stunts becomes a thing as well. But this is the first time I can remember in, I mean, I'm going to say I've been watching the Oscars for decades now, right? And mm-hmm. so I've mm-hmm. seen dozens of these ceremonies. And I think I could probably count on less than one hand how many times they've ended early. Yes. So the fact that they ended early, I think, is a huge testament to how well produced this was and how good the logistics were. One of the things they did that really helped was they had presenters double up on the awards. So mm-hmm. they would have a presenter go up and do two awards. And that just saves so much time from a like transition perspective. So yeah, overall, I enjoyed watching the ceremony. I hope people out there did as well. And some good movies got awards and very little to complain about, I would say. So yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, those were some thoughts on this year's Academy Awards. Let's take a break for a sponsor. We'll be right back with what we've been watching right after this. All right, folks, let's do some what we've been watching. Devendra Hardwar, you and I had a chance to watch Ricky Stenicki.
Yeah, an upcoming Oscar nominee, I'm sure, for next year, right?
This is definitely in the Best Picture race for next year. Ricky Stenicki is a new movie that's out on Prime Video. Devendra, how did this get on your radar? I'm just curious.
I mean, it's Cena. Cena is Zac Efron. We love Zac Efron. We love John Cena. And also, I saw people who saw this movie early on saying it was a lot of fun. I have seen the trailer for this, and it seems like good Cena vibes. And in fact, I was thinking this is exactly what Jeff wants from John Cena. So I hope
I'm definitely excited to watch this. I think actually my wife and I are set to watch it tomorrow night.
Awesome. Oh,
nice. Just
awesome.
Missing our recording time.
Yep.
Yeah. Peter Farrelly directed this movie. This is one of his follow-ups to Green Book, you know, so definitely showing he still has got the comedic range there. But Ricky Stenicki, sure. I'm going to reveal the premise, Jeff, so if you want to peace out for a minute, you're welcome to. But Ricky Stenicki is about this trio of friends who play a prank that goes wrong when they're kids, and so they invent an imaginary friend named Ricky Stenicki to take the blame. And Ricky Stenicki becomes a person they use throughout their lives. And then when they grow up, they realize at one point that they need to actually figure out a way to make Ricky Stenicki into a real person who ends up being John Cena. And that's all mm-hmm. I will say about the plot of the film. But I got to say, Devendra, against my better judgment, I really enjoyed this movie. This is the kind of movie that if it came out in the 90s in theaters, it would make like $120 million at the box office. Like,
absolutely. This is a straight studio comedy.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. We used to turn out as a society for these kinds of movies that are kind of gross out. And even though they're gross out and have wildly inappropriate stuff in them, ultimately, Devendra, I think these movies have a very conservative core to them, which is affirming the importance of family and marriage and those connections. And I think that's definitely true in the case of Ricky Stenicki as well. Sure. What did you appreciate about this movie?
I do dislike the idea of saying that is a very conservative thing because everybody, in fact, likes having family and everything. But I think what I would say is that it has a lot of heart to it.
Yeah.
And that is something, even going back, look at all of Adam Sandler's 90 movies, the Waterboy has so much heart to it. Like that was part of the appeal back then. So to see Peter Farrelly giving us basically a throwback to one of those, I think it's a ton of fun. It's not entirely successful, I'd say. I think the script, I don't think all the jokes land. I'm not a huge fan of the entire cast, especially. I think what I've realized is I don't like Andrew Santino as a comedic presence. Wow. I guess.
Harsh.
Whatever this movie is giving him, I'm just not.
Yeah.
I'm not picking it up. But Zac Efron is good, and John Cena is gold.
Yes.
Absolute gold.
He's great.
He just really throws himself into all the stupidity they give him. He plays a guy just doing the dumbest thing in Atlantic City. Like, he is a singer who sings about jerking off. That is what he does. And they have costumes, they have songs, and he just gives his all into the stupidity and the silliness of it. And I got to give the guy credit for that. Like, very few people would do that. It's fantastic. So he is fun to watch. As Efron is good. It's a fun ride, and John Cena is just hilarious in it.
Yeah, I had a great time with it. I think people will really enjoy this. If you are into the gross out Farrelly comedies of Farrelly Brothers comedies of the 90s, mm-hmm. I think you'll have a great time. But it's also like it struck me that we don't see that many movies get made like this these days. That are just like in this kind of weird genre, gross out R-rated comedy. Like first of all, we're seeing very few comedies being released in theaters, period. And then when they are done to appeal to the widest group possible. And so they typically aren't rated R. But this is a rated R comedy. It's like proudly on the poster and the box art that it's a rated R comedy. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's just kind of a rare bird. And I admire the fact that it exists. And if you grew up watching movies like Dumb and Dumber and There's Something About Mary, this will make you feel like you're back in the 90s again. And
there are several physical comedy bits. There's at least one animal that wreaks havoc. Like it feels like such a throwback. I think that's the appeal here. I will say it also feels weird that we don't see too many comedies like this when like we had the whole Judd Apatow era, right? In like the post Apatow era, it just feels like there's nothing right now comedy wise happening.
Yeah. I agree. It's because it's hard for them to make money in the box office these days. Mm-hmm. These days. But that's why we are seeing them on services like Prime Video, which is where you can watch Ricky Stenicki. And that's one thing we've been watching this week. Devendra, hit us up with something else you've been watching this week.
Oh, real quick. I saw Kung Fu Panda 4. That movie came out. It's been...
Was this like a thing you want to do with your kids? Like, what was the motivation here? I almost considered advocating for this as a main review, but it's like, I think... There's just not enough interest in either this podcast
or the audience.
We're Kung
Fu Panda'd out at this point.
Yeah, that's my feeling.
Maybe. It's been almost 10 years, guys, since Kung Fu Panda 3. So there's that. So what had happened was a family at my kid's school had invited us to a private screening. They were just like, hey, come, movies. We have the whole theater for our family and stuff. So it was a cool, like, private showing of Kung Fu Panda 4, and I was able to take my daughter to it. This is only the second time she's been able to go to the theater, so we had a lot of fun. And the movie itself is, it's not as good as the earlier Kung Fu Pandas, but still, it's not bad. I've seen far worse kid stuff these days. And this is like, it continues the adventure of Po and the Dragon Warrior, and he's maturing and he's getting to another stage in his life. It introduces new characters, including one played by Awkwafina. Really new fun spins on the villains, because the villain this time is a chameleon who can take the powers of the previous villains. So you even get like some of the old voices back, which is like Ian McShane, you get his voice back, which is a lot of fun to see. I think it's just like a fun action movie. It looks very good. The choreography is good. The action is really inventive. That's something I've always like liked about this series. It's sort of like if you took a Jackie Chan movie and made it for kids and kind of got the irreverent comedy of his action sequences in there. That's what I've always liked about Kung Fu Panda. So this still has that. Unfortunately, Jackie Chan is not in it. The rest of the supporting cast are just off on other adventures. So they just kind of made this thing, you know, very much a Poe-centric story, Poe and Awkwafina. It is in some ways almost feels like a Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon remake, too. Like, there's just all these little bits of references in here that I think just are a lot of fun. But it's essentially a kid's movie with good action. It's good for kids. And I think it's good for people who like martial arts movies, because you will see what this movie is doing. It's doing some really interesting stuff here. Directed by Mike Mitchell and Stephanie Stein. And probably not worth running out to the theater for. But I've also seen people complain that there just aren't good movies for kids right now. We've gone... I would say several weekends, probably even months, with like some genuinely great kids movies in theaters. So this is one. It's worth going to, but you can also just wait for home for this one, too. The one I'm really looking forward to is The Wild Robot. And the trailer for that's the new one from the How to Train Your Dragon guy, Dave. And that movie looks fantastic.
I saw the trailer last night during the Oscars, and I was transfixed. I thought it's
beautiful.
This looks amazing. So
beautiful,
I'm really
wordless trailer.
That.
It also looks like a movie about the robot from Castle in the Sky. So I wonder if Ghibli fans are going to have kind of a fit about this, but it looks fun. So there are things to look forward to this year. And Kung Fu Panda is definitely worth seeing if you can, and especially if you have kids.
Yeah, I was a fan of the Kung Fu Panda franchise. I kind of fell off because it's just, as you said, it's been so long since the last one. But do you think I guess it's a weird question to ask, but do you think this, quote unquote, needed to be made, right? What I mean by that is, do you feel like it added meaningfully to the Kung Fu Panda lore sure. in a way that you're like, oh, or as opposed to just here's a, here's another
that's what
Poe
the kids
adventure.
Care about.
That's what the
kids care about. You know, they care about the
I know
lore.
It's not what
the,
it's what I care about. It's what I care about. That's why I'm asking Devendra about it.
I think it is worth keeping this franchise alive. I will say that because mm-hmm. I think it is a great premise. They did some really good work early on. And, you know, we have so many we have kid focused things that deal with action, but they don't often do action well and they don't often like treat the stuff with respect. So I think this is like just one of those rare series that's worth keeping around. I believe there was a TV show too. My daughter has never seen any Kung Fu Panda movies, but she is now very interested in this universe. So we'll be going back and watching some of the older ones now.
Well, that's Kung Fu Panda 4. It is right now in theaters. Jeff Cannata, hit us up with something you've been watching.
Well, my wife and I dove into a new Netflix series called One Day, and we tore through this. People might be familiar with One Day because it was actually a film. This is based on a novel, and the novel was turned into a film back in 2011 with Anne Hathaway and I think it was Jim Sturgis as the guy. The premise here, the conceit, the gimmick is that we check in to these two individuals who meet in college. We check in on them on the same day every year for numerous years. So it starts, the series starts in 1988, and one episode of the series is each year. So it's July 15th, I think it is, 1988. And then the next episode is July 15th, 1989, and July 15th, 1990. And then it keeps going. Each episode of the series is a different year, but the same day, the same date of that year. And we're checking in on these people's lives and we see them grow and change over time. And their relationship is really, I would say, atypical for a rom-com, which is this ostensibly is. But these people, there's like attraction at the beginning and then they sort of become friends for many, many years. And their lives take very divergent paths. And it's... my wife and I have very much enjoyed this. I think there's a bunch of episodes and they're all in varying lengths, but relatively short. They're more the half hour, closer to the half hour length, although some creep up to like 40, 45 minutes. But it's not an hour template drama. It is much more the half hour and very digestible. And because each episode is a different year, it really works well as a series. I never saw that 2011 version with Anne Hathaway. I don't know if it's any good, but I would have a hard time. I would imagine that the added length that this show is afforded results in the story being told in, I think, a much better way. I would assume so. I would think that cramming this into a 2-hour movie would lose a lot of the nuance that I found in the series. And I think the two leads are quite good. Leo Woodall, who you guys probably know, is just this chiseled out of a piece of marble human. He's like impossibly handsome human being, and which is exactly the character. This character that he plays, Dexter. This, by the way, set in England. It's a British, couple of British kids. And his character comes from money. He's never had to work a day in his life. Everything comes easy. Everybody loves him. He's super charming, gets by on his looks and charm. So perfect casting for Leo Woodall, who I think is like, you know, one of those people that is, you just look at and go, oh, there's a movie star. That's obviously a movie star. His camera loves him. And then an actress that I was not familiar with before this, her name is Ambika Maud. I think she is a revelation. She is phenomenal. I can't wait to see where she goes next. Looking at her IMDb, she's only done a few things and most of them are like one episode here, two episodes there of series. So, I think this might be among her first kind of big roles. And boy, is she up for the challenge. She is just great. I think she's quite beautiful, but certainly not in that oh dear God, a lightning bolt struck and then a human was there vein. And that's very much the character, right? She's sort of like a normal human and mm-hmm. she butts up against this, this boy who's, you know, just, Greek God. And that's what's the joy of the show is like, she has normal human concerns and normal human life. And this guy, he ends up, it's fun because it takes place in the '90s. And I was, you know, I very much, recall the '90s and loved the '90s. And he, you know, he becomes a VJ and then he becomes like a video game reviewer. And it's like, oh man, I'm very much into this. where she like goes and becomes a school teacher and like lives a much more, I think, what you would consider to be, you know, a normal life, where he's like just, you know, hobnobbing with all these wealthy people and getting plucked out of into stardom for having done almost nothing. And the dichotomy of that, the fun relationship that they maintain and then is strained because of that, is the drama, is the fun of seeing these lives that are going in such different directions, them trying to still relate to one another and care for one another and live in each other's worlds, even though the worlds are so different. And my wife and I both really enjoy it. I think the writing is very smart and charming. It's funny and fun, and the people are quite likable, and you just kind of fall in love with them. And there's some heartbreaking moments of missed opportunity and some real tragedies that happen in their lives. And I'm enamored, as people who listen to this podcast for a long time probably already are aware, I'm enamored with any story that is talking about the passage of time. I think the passage of time is a fascinating subject mm-hmm. for drama. And this show is very much about that, right? One day every year for, you know, 20 years, basically. And, you know, seeing how people evolve and change and how what life does to you. And you're just jumping in a single day each year. And you know, the show you can infer all the changes that have happened in the interim. And as an episode ends, you go, oh, I bet I know where they're going to be next year. And there's a fun in that. And I think it works very, very well as a Netflix show that you can binge. It works very, very well as an episodic show where everything can be encapsulated in that moment in time. And that's an episode is that moment in time, that year. So we very much liked one day. And I think it's easy breezy viewing. It's really charming. It's sweet. The acting is great. And I recommend it. One day.
Yeah, Jeff, I'm gonna check this out. This sounds really cool. I also want to recommend to you and your wife Normal People, which I've been talking about for a couple of years. It's on Hulu. This sounds like a lot more fun than what Normal People is, because that's more of like an actual relationship drama that covers a couple of years between two people who clearly have a connection. But I think you guys would enjoy it. It's fantastic.
Jeff, I'm reminded of this Onion article that I love referring to, Man's Life Riddled with Continuity Errors. You remember this,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
A quote from the article. The whole thing is kind of a mess, frankly. If you look at it with a critical eye, none of it makes any sense. There's all these weird shifts in occupation and opinions and relationships, not to mention the weight gain and weight loss and weight gain again. One minute he's living with his parents. The next he has an apartment with some girlfriend who shows up out of nowhere. And then all of a sudden he's crashing at a friend's place in a completely different city without any explanation, end quote. You know, it's kind of like life so often doesn't go in a straight line. And it sounds like that concept is a little bit brought to life, at least in the show One Day.
Yeah, I would say that's a central theme to the show is the strange trajectories, you know, and the show very much starts, and I'm assuming the novel is the same way, very much starts of like, hey, this is a very conventional rom-com where these two people are going to fall in love and live happily ever after. And then it's like, no, that's not really how life works. It's much more complicated than that and much more interesting than that, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I've heard this is a very powerful series, right? On Netflix.
Yes.
Series, not a show. Yeah. So series.
I think it's a finite
limited,
series.
Yeah. Limited series. Right.
Yeah.
Limited series. Yeah. So I've heard great things about this as well. I will try to check it out as well. One Day on Netflix. Let's take another break for a sponsor. We'll be back with more what we've been watching right after this. All right. I want to mention something I've been watching that I can't remember anyone I know ever mentioning this film in my entire life. This is the movie called Unthinkable. Have you guys heard about this movie?
Yeah.
I can't think of it.
I often think that the Netflix top 10 movies is kind of like, I find it anthropologically interesting, but also interesting from a from a tech perspective, right? As in, you know, why did Netflix decide this is the thing that a lot of people need to be served? This is the thing in their spotlight, you know, that needs to be served up. So, for instance, I recently talked about the documentary on Netflix called Lover, Stalker, Killer, which I thought was okay, entertaining, but really is missing critical context about what actually happens in that show. But it's about like catfishing and cyber stalking and stuff that's very relevant to today, you know, like stuff that I'm like, oh, I kind of understand why people would be interested in this today, because it's online dating and stalking and people pretending to be people they're not and, you know, doing weird ass shit. Like, that's free. Yeah, I get it. I get why people would be into Lover, Stalker, Killer on Netflix. So I was browsing Netflix's top 10 movies after the Oscars last night, being like, I need something to wind down with. Because, you know, I did a live broadcast after the Oscars, wrote a post at Decoding Everything. I'm like, I need something to wind down with. I saw this movie was either number 8 or 9 on the top 10 list. It's called Unthinkable. It's directed by Gregor Jordan. It is a 2010 American thriller.
Good God.
That's essentially about, like, Michael Sheen plays an American, which is very rare. You typically don't see him playing an American dude, but he does an American accent very
Again, you aptly. Guys got to watch The Good Fight. But yeah, yeah.
He plays a terrorist who has planted nuclear weapons in 3 cities. And the idea is that they're trying to get the information out of him, and Samuel L. Jackson and Carrie Ann Moss play kind of agents of the government who are trying to get this information out of him, but who may disagree on the use of torture to extract this information. And it just struck me that movies are often the movies that get made are very often a reflection of the anxieties that we have at that moment in time in our society, right? And I remember, during this time period, in the George W. Bush era, there were a bunch of movies about the United States
using torture.
This is the
Obama era, buddy.
Fair enough. Post George W. Bush era, stuff that was greenlit in the George W. Bush era. but I remember also like the series 24, right? That was a huge deal, and that mm-hmm. used torture quite a bit. Devendra, I remember like it was almost
so
like
much
a common aspect
the government.
Of the show was to show how effective torture is at extracting information from mm-hmm. enemy combatants. This movie, Unthinkable, is very much about that topic. It's, should we torture if it means we can save millions of lives? What does it mean to become a people that torture, and what's the net effect of it? Sadly, the movie is not very good. I don't think the movie is like kind of silly and over the top, and you know, you get to see Samuel L. Jackson playing a badass torturing guys, but like, it's not really a particularly deep film, in my opinion. It asks a lot of questions. It doesn't really provide many answers or even a pathway to get to any answers that I think are particularly profound. But I just thought it was, and also I just want to conclude, I have no idea why this movie is so popular right now. Like, I tried to kind of think through, like, why is this, you know? And it's like, I don't
it's
know
the algorithm,
why this
man.
Is.
This is one of the consequences of the algorithm. Is like, the algorithm knows this movie exists. Nobody else does. But the algorithm knows people love spy shit and stuff
right.
around the fighting.
That's what you did, though, Dave. You made sure it stayed there. That's what you did.
this mention on what we've been watching is going to send millions of people scrambling to their Netflix queues.
The
to,
algorithm
like,
wins.
Add to my list.
Yeah, the algorithm knew.
I do think you're right. Spy thriller, and also the fact that it has some big stars: Samuel L. Jackson, Michael Sheen, and Carrie Ann Moss are in it. This movie was released direct to DVD when it originally came out.
Wow.
And now it's, you know, millions of people are watching it. And this is something that Netflix has shown over and over again it can do. Mm-hmm. It can take any random ass shit and potentially make it into a huge kind of deal on the service. Now, it doesn't mm-hmm. it doesn't have 100% success rate or anything like that. But another example is Loudermilk. I don't know if you guys saw that show. But
yes, my wife is watching that show. I did not know that existed.
Right, that is not a show. That is a show
it was
that
buried deep.
Premiered, and then it debuted on Amazon Prime. It did not become a hit on Amazon Prime. And then it hit Netflix, became one of the top 10 TV shows of the country. And so this is a thing that I think we'll see more and more of, is random shows and movies from the past now become a big deal. Fear, by the way, the Mark Wahlberg stalker thriller, Fear. Yep. That is like one of the top five movies on Netflix consistently for the last week.
Well, it's a 90s classic. I mean, come on.
Yeah, sure.
There's a reason that movie is still kicking. But it's the novelty of some of these things, too. Like, I did not know Loudermilk existed because Amazon is such trash at promoting the stuff it has. You know, like, it'll produce things but never actually get the eyeballs to it. So, yeah, I'm not surprised. Not surprised about that. But for this movie, yeah, it has all the elements of something people want.
Yeah. As somebody who used to work in Amazon's marketing department.
I think anybody who worked there should be ashamed of themselves, to be honest. But
anyone who ever
worked employ over at that garbage location?
Listen, former Amazon employee, have you seen The Underground Railroad yet?
It is on my list. It is on my list. And I've heard it's amazing.
In fact, you know, not to cast too much shade, but I know that was probably part of your workflow at some point, Dave. And you got to see it. Everybody has to see it. Amazon can't even get their employees to watch their own shows. That's where we are.
I watched and still watch a lot of Amazon Prime Video programming. I'm just going to put that out there. So
not Bosch, not the Underground Railroad. So
anyway,
I got a list, guys. I've told you this.
Unthinkable. If you see this pop up on your Netflix queue, I do not think it is very good. But
you would rather start watching a random Netflix movie that you had never heard of rather than things we have been recommending
for years.
This
was my winding down.
Amazing.
Seeing Samuel Jackson cut a guy's fingers off, this was my winding down after the Oscars thing, okay?
You felt like, Jack Bauer vibes.
I need some Jack Bauer vibes in my life right now, and that is what I'm going to do. But anyway, if you see this pop up on your Netflix queue, I would say it is unfortunately not that good. And there's other shows you can watch instead, including the stuff that we mentioned on this podcast today. So that is Unthinkable. It is something else I've been watching. Devendra Hardwar, you had a chance to check out one of the best
classics. Listen, let me set this up.
Yeah,
yes.
Please, go ahead. Go ahead.
I saw a movie on the Criterion Channel this week, guys. It's a 2001 entry from one of comedy's most daring creators. A film at the time, which I think audiences and critics we're not quite ready for. And it's debatable if anybody is ready for this movie. But of course, I'm talking about the masterpiece, the single film ever produced by Mr. Tom Green, Freddy Got Fingered. It is on Criterion Channel right now. Freddy Got Fingered.
Dude was way ahead of his time, by the way.
Wait, absolutely! Jeff!
He presaged all YouTube.
Jackass?
Yeah,
everything. Well, he presaged Jackass, like Johnny TikTok, Knoxville.
He basically was doing TikTok videos before there was TikTok or videos.
I believe Johnny Knoxville said that he had taped like all the Tom Green Show stuff and like was watching it obsessively pre Jackass and everything. So, listen, Tom Green, for people
doesn't
who
mean it was good.
It doesn't mean it was good, but he was the avant-garde comedian of the late '90s. Freddy Got Fingered was his one chance to make a movie himself. I think he was in other films too. I remember this movie getting eviscerated as one of the worst things ever made. I never actually saw it during the time, but it showed up on the Criterion Channel because Criterion has this Razzie Award
collection.
Because
Criterion has good taste? Anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
Criterion clearly has good taste, but no, they put up, you know, a bunch of films that have won Razzies. Geely is up there too. They just put it up there in the separate collection. And I think I started watching it just for the novelty of saying I watched Freddy Got Fingered on the Criterion Channel, which I'm paying to also see, you know, tremendous Oscar-worthy films and beautiful international films. But I also saw Freddy Got Fingered on this service. It is not a good movie, guys, but it's also... Jeff, did you actually see this movie?
I think I did.
Okay.
I mean, 2001, it came out. It's literally almost 25 years ago. It's insane.
Oh, so God. Oh, God.
Barely remember it.
It is a movie. It is almost an anti-movie. It is a movie that is created to mess with you, the audience, also to mess directly with critics. Like, it is, you give Tom Green millions of dollars to make a feature film. This is what ends up happening. And I will say the end result is kind of fascinating. Like, it's not always successful, but it is just wild how crazy it goes. And looking at it now in retrospect and seeing like where Jackass went and where a lot of like prank comedy went since then, like he was somebody doing something pretty wild out there as a feature film. And this thing was released in theaters. It was produced by a major film studio. There are scenes of this man jacking off a horse that happened. And yet I think it's worth watching. I think there's some like actually funny bits here. Rip Torn, who plays his father, is hilarious in this movie. And I would not have realized that if I didn't end up watching it. So, you know, Rip Torn, kind of like the John Cena thing we're talking about from Ricky Stenicki, like, okay, you give him trash at times, but he will go all for it. And he certainly gave his all for this movie. It's not a great movie, guys, but it is certainly like an interesting one and a fascinating one. And I think there is some value there. And I think that's the value of Criterion Channel being like, hey, look, these are Razzie Award winning movies. I guess they're all trash, right? I don't think so. In fact, the Razzies may be trash, right?
I just think the Razzies is one of the worst things that's ever happened in society. You know, so like,
so it's almost, yeah, that whole collection is like Criterion giving like a big straight up middle finger to the Razzies, yeah. Being like, we can highlight these movies. Actually, yeah.
What I mean, let me just clarify what I mean about the Razzies. I think they, first of all, it's like a very obviously very mean spirited at its core, but also, but the problem with the Razzies is not the mean spiritedness; it is how boring the choices are. Like, they always choose like the thing that everyone loves to beat up on. They're not actually choosing the actual worst movies of the year, because that would actually be interesting. They instead choose boring things where like people already are complaining or beating up on these movies, and they're just, you know, there's already blood in the water, and so they just go after them. And I hate them. I hate them. Okay. Anyway, Freddy Got Fingered. How is Stephen Tobolowsky in this movie, by the way, during your hardware? Did you?
He is in it briefly. Very briefly.
Yeah. Apparently they cut out a lot of his role.
I will say it is worth... Yeah. This could have been the one. This could have been his like star ticket. Yeah. No, I remember him being good there. I will say there is a good, great Roger Ebert, a negative review of this movie. But then I believe like a year or two later, he came back and he is doing what we're doing right now. And he's like, you know what? You may not agree with Tom Green's comedy. In fact, you may not even find it funny, but he is going for something. And he respected that. And that was another thing that made me realize, like, yeah, Roger Ebert does kind of get it sometimes, at least when he's not talking about video games. Yeah.
That's Freddy Got Fingered on the Criterion Channel. Jeff Cannata, looks like you have a late breaking addition to the What We've Been Watching list. Am I reading this correctly?
Nearly forgot this happened, Dave, because I tried to block it out of my memory.
Well, it looks like, from what I can tell,
talk about it a lot.
Yeah, from what I can tell, what we'll be watching, it looks like you actually listened to one of my recommendations for once. Is that
well?
Is
let me lay the scene for you.
Yeah,
because
lay the scene out. I'd love to hear it.
We did talk about this at length already, but here's what happened. My lovely, beautiful, amazing wife has of late, relatively late, gotten into some wonderful new friend groups here in Denver. We've moved not too long ago, and we relocated here. And you know, it takes a while to make friends. But she's got these mom groups with kids that are in class with our kids, and she's really made some wonderful friends. And it's delights me no end to see it happen. And now she's got her social calendar has filled up. They have a book club that they go do and don't talk about a book, but just drink wine and talk all night. And they go and they went skiing together. They go to dinner. They have birthday parties. It's a delight. Well, this week, my wife went to one of these functions and I was home by myself, and she comes in late, all a flutter, all a buzz, having just been out with her friends, having a great, wonderful time. And I was delighted to see it. She comes in and she says, honey, I'm sitting on the couch, by the way, watching something. I don't remember what. And she goes, honey, I got to show you something. I just heard about it. My friend group, everybody's talking about it. I was like, what? What is it? She's like, just give me the remote. You're not going to believe this. And I go, okay. And she goes, okay. And she turns on Netflix and she goes, close your eyes. I don't want you to see what I'm searching for. I'm like, okay. All right, here we go. And she types in the thing. She's like, okay, I'm going to put it on and then you're going to open your eyes and we're going to watch it. And I was like, okay. And what my wife doesn't realize is that I, for hours every week, I talk to Dave Chen. Uh-huh, uh-huh. So there's nothing.
Mm-hmm. There's nothing she could show you that could shock you, basically.
That's right. There's nothing that she could show me that I haven't already heard described at length to me. But hours at a time.
This is the process your wife has to go through to get you to watch something, Jeff. That's right. This is how she has to get her recommendations through to you.
That's
like
right.
Blindfold you like a freaking kidnapped hostage. Yeah.
It's true. It's true. And so what she put on was Bosch. No, I'm just kidding.
Yes.
She puts on Netflix hit reality series Naked Attraction.
Yeah. FYI, it is not Netflix. It is Max the one to watch for HBO. But yeah.
Pardon me. Max the one to watch for HBO. I didn't know my eyes were closed at the time.
Right, right. Of course.
When she selected the app.
He didn't hear the sounds or anything?
No.
The launching sound.
You can't
sound,
identify
yeah.
the Max, the one to watch for HBO audio bumper by memory, Jeff Cannata?
It's not, you'd but think. It's not ta-dum.
It is not ta-dum. It's more of it's, a...
Let's do the... Here is the Max, the one to watch for HBO sound when you're trying... It's... Right? Is that, you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah, it's true.
The,
yeah,
the Max true. Like it's flies out. It's like,
boom, boom.
Yeah, it's not. It's.
Either way.
I think there's more melody to it, you know, Dave.
Yeah,
but,
are you sure?
Know.
Are you sure? Okay. I don't know. I think I nailed it. Yeah. Anyway, go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah.
Do Prime now. What's Prime? Mr. I used to work there.
Dun, dun, dun. It's something like that these days.
Sound not found.
It changes. Yeah. Dun, dun, dun. You know, that's the Prime thing.
Yeah, yeah. Thum, bum, bum. Yeah. Anyway, all that and more on our podcast entitled The Sounds of Streaming. No, she puts on Max the One to Watch for HBO's hit reality series, Naked Attraction, which if you've listened to this podcast, you know that Dave is a huge fan of.
Mm-hmm.
This is the show about people looking at the revealed lower halves of other people who are naked and deciding if they want to go on a date with them based on their genitalia. And it was everything Dave described and more.
Well, not based only on their genitalia, also their other body parts like their legs and waist and sure. chest and stuff.
Sure, yeah. Sure, sure. There's a lot of emphasis on the genitalia, though. I'll be honest.
A little bit of a spotlight
especially
there.
Especially on the episode that we watched. yeah, it's hard to convey it if you haven't seen it, because the thing, and I think you mentioned this, but I just want to underscore it for people that maybe don't recall our conversation about Naked Attraction from a previous episode.
Mm-hmm. AKA no one, but go ahead.
Yes. the process could not be less sexy. It is the least titillating, the least there. It is devoid of any kind of sensuality or
mm-hmm.
it is like a clinical appraisal
right
of a dong. It's like, well, what do you think about that dong? Well, you know, I prefer them a little thinner and longer, and I, you know, I do enjoy the fact that it is, you know, I do like the hair. I like hair in that place, and it's like I can only assume that anybody tuning into this show is on some level, even if they don't admit it to themselves, hoping to be titillated, right?
Oh, absolutely. But I can imagine the pitch meeting for the show is somebody going up to whiteboard and just writing P plus V. That's the show.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? That's yeah. it. That's all. We're just
you down with
P
OPP?
Plus V.
Yeah, you yeah. know me, you know? I'm down with OPP, every last homie. But there is no...
Amazing.
There is no hint of even like... Like the most obnoxious porn has
more sensuality in it than this show. It's like a doctor is examining an X-ray of a femur. That's, they're like, well, you see, there's a break there, and it's kind of crooked like that. It's,
I think
crazy
they may
to
have
me.
To do that, right? Do they have to do that to make it not actually be porn?
I guess.
To be more clinical
but
and not like sexual about it. Yeah.
Then like, why are we here? What is happening? Good question. You know?
Why are
what
we
was
here?
Your what was your wife's reaction, or what was your reaction to your wife? Were you like, this is great, love this, you know, or I hate this?
I hate it and hated it. And she hated it too. The thing that we couldn't believe. neither of us could believe how just completely unsexy it was. Mm-hmm. Like you take something, the whole point of watching it is like, well, hey, let's cut to the chase and like see the sexy bits and decide if you want to be with someone based on their sexy bits. But there's no sexy. It is completely clinical and dry and staid, you know? Right? Am I'm not wrong about that, right, Dave?
No, absolutely. Absolutely.
It's very weird.
It's also, I'm just going
to
put this out there, like quite dehumanizing for the participants.
Well, sure.
Right? Like, I would imagine.
Well, the weirdest part is then they have the people come out and like dance naked when they haven't been picked. It's like, oh, she hates your dong. Let's come out and dance now. And he's like, yeah. And then they're like, how do you feel? And he's like, well, I feel so much better about myself. Really? Because she just told you she doesn't like your dong, dude. That's what she told you. I have nothing to do with it.
It also sounds like it's unfair to the dongs because, you know, there are stages.
Sure.
There's stages,
yeah.
You know, and what stage is this being previewed at? Is
exactly.
that unfair to the gentleman? I
it's
don't know.
It's a grower, not a shower, is what
exactly.
I'd say.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This is an anti-grower reality
yeah.
show.
Yeah. yeah. And how was the what's the ambient temperature? They should post the ambient mm-hmm. temperature mm-hmm. in the room there alongside the dong.
Well, I'm sorry you did not enjoy Naked Attraction on Max, someone to watch for HBO, but. I hope you were at least able to tell your wife that David Chen had told you about the show. And
I did. I was like,
you're a worldly man, you know, as a result.
The moment it started, I was like, oh no, Dave told me about this already.
Anytime Dave has already told you about something is when it's like, oh no. The dread.
Oh no, here we go. This is a Dave recommendation.
Dread that creeps in, you know?
She was very disappointed that she was not the one revealing this to me, but she never is.
She was so excited about it too. Made you do the whole blindfold thing.
Yeah. Oh, she was very excited. She was going to blow my mind, and I was like, oh, sorry, Dave already.
So
blew
really
my
blow
mind.
Your mind by starting to watch Bosch without you, Jeff. That's what you're asking for.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, glad you got to walk a mile in my shoes, Jeff Cannata, and watch Naked Attraction.
And there's like 417 seasons of this thing, right?
Yes.
It's like been on forever.
Yes. Yeah, it's been on for like a decade. So,
yeah.
Yeah. Lots of episodes.
Amazing.
All right. Anyway, that's going to bring us to the end of what we've been watching. Let's get to a few weekly plugs. Weekly plugs, the part of the show each week where we plug something else we've been making. Guys, I do not do guest spots on podcasts very often. I have a lot of difficulty maintaining the podcast that I am already involved with.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But when I do guest on podcasts, it's only for podcasts whose names mean the substance or essence of a speech or text, which is why I find myself appearing on Mike Pesca's The Gist podcast recently, talking about all the movies that were nominated for an Oscar. I was repping the film cast on that show. By the way, Mike, you know, we have appeared on podcasts where people say, hey, I'm a big fan. You know, I'm a big fan of you. Do you want to come on my podcast? And I'm going to say some of the times those people are not actually big fans.
No, oh, absolutely.
Sometimes they just say that.
I know you're lying, PR people. I know you're lying. Yeah.
But when I appeared on Mike Pesca's...
Really? That's never happened to me.
Really?
Interesting.
Wow, Jeff, you're so lucky. Everyone's legit a big fan of you. That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. Yet another way in which you're better than us, Jeff. Anyway. But I could tell immediately from like in the first 30 seconds that Mike was actually an avid listener of the podcast, or at least he listened to one episode.
he just listened to enough to get the gist.
Yeah, to get the gist. Right? But he knew about the limericks, and he knew about like all like our wild opinions on various films, and that's lovely. You know, that's lovely. When
that's sweet
when they actually comes from a place of mutual admiration. So anyway. Check out my appearance on The Gist. I'll link to it in the show notes. We talk about all the movies that were nominated for Oscars, and it was a really fun time. Also, I did a Boom Goes the Dynamite joke, but I did not say boom. I was not bold enough to say boom, and I regret that deeply. So
what? But why wouldn't you?
Because I was like, I'm on another guy's podcast. Can I really do the boom? Can
you,
I do the
full
boom?
You absolutely can. That's you in fact, you, that, that's, yeah.
You
that's
bring the boom into the room with you.
Move. I have deep shame about not completing the boom, but I did do every other component of the joke. So fans of the boom will enjoy my appearance on the Gist podcast. Devinder Hardware, your weekly plug.
Sure. Last week, Apple reviewed they released new MacBook Airs, and I got to take a look at them. So I reviewed the MacBook Air M3, the 13-inch and 15-inch over to Engadget. So go check that out. And we also talked about it on the Engadget podcast. These are good computers, but I think my main takeaway is that the M2 MacBook Air is still pretty sweet. It's in fact cheaper now, and you can probably find it used with a lot of RAM. So that's actually the best deal you can get right now on a Mac. So let's keep an eye out for those.
I have one of those exact machines, and I love mine.
I love it.
I think it's great.
So good. Yeah. It's a marvel of engineering. Yeah.
Jeff Cannata, your weekly plug?
Well, this happened a while back, and I neglected to talk about it. I am remiss in not talking about it sooner. I did another audiobook. So I've talked about the first audiobook I did several years ago. I did a new audiobook that just came out, I think last month is when it was released. It's called The Light of Shadows. It's by Ryan Elledge. A new fantasy author who approached me and asked if I would narrate the audio book version of his novel. And I had quite a lot of fun doing it. It's called The Light of Shadows. It's a fantasy story, in the vein of Tolkien or Game of Thrones or that kind of stuff. If you're into those kinds of stories, it's good fun. And I think, if I recall 100%, I'm pretty certain that there's some actiony stuff and a little bit of mild violence, but I think it's pretty much suitable for all ages. I don't think there's any real risque things or language that's objectionable. So you could listen to this one in the car with younger listeners around. So that might be a selling point for some. I don't get anything if people buy this. I just want to promote it because I'm part of it and I had a good time. I did a bunch of goofy voices, as I like to do, for the book. It's called The Light of Shadows. It's by Ryan Elledge. It's available on Audible and Amazon and anywhere you get audiobooks.
All right. I, of course, want to throw out a shout out to the Patreon at patreon.com/filmpodcast. We just completed our Dune sequence where we talked about all the Dune movies in recent memory.
Yeah, we won't be doing the Sci-Fi Channel series. That's a whole trek.
We're going to skip that sci-fi. But we talked about we revisited Dune Part 1. We talked about the David Lynch Dune. Of course, we also talked about a variety of random other stuff, stories from our lives that are funny and occasionally pointless and often result in our humiliation. So please be sure to check that out at patreon.com/filmpodcast. We never want anyone to donate if it causes you financial hardship. It's very easy to support us for free. Leave a star rating for us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts, or a review, or share any of our videos that we post on YouTube or Instagram. It really does help to keep the show going. Let's get to our review of The Promised Land.
Ludwig Kahn, welcome to Helgos.
Du vil forsøge at dyrke heden.
Jeg vil bygge kongens første koloni derude.
Det er fantastisk, det du er i gang med. Jeg får redan en kjensle af liv herude.
Heden er Guds natur i al sin pragt. Hvorfor kastrere et vildt væs, der bare gerne vil være frit?
Men har Gud netop ikke sat mennesker på jorden for at skabe civilisation?
Welcome to the Filmcast review of The Promised Land. Newest film by director Nikolaj Arcel. In 18th century Denmark, impoverished war hero Captain Ludwig Kahn sets out to tame a vast uninhabitable land on which seemingly nothing can grow, end quote. Now, I had started hearing like random bits from different critics and filmmakers saying this movie is incredible, and then it just hit video on demand, so we thought, let's give it a shot, and let's just talk about what our overall thoughts are. Devinder Hardware, what did you think of The Promised Land?
Yeah, I freaking love this movie. It made me realize that when Mads Mikkelsen cries, I cry. And it's just, that's what happened.
Happened a lot.
Well, it happened in another round as well. I was like, man, he has one of the most iconic faces in cinema, right? And most of the time it is like stone-faced and grim staring at somebody, but there's so much going on there. And this movie is a lot of stone-faced Mads Mikkelsen too, but it also like it changes, and he is changing as a character too throughout this thing. I love a great big sweeping historical epic. I love a story about, you know, essentially a commoner versus annoying rich, you know, rich people. So, and showing off like how kind of useless basically governments are in these situations too. This is a Western. This is a Western set in the Danish wilderness. It's about a soldier who starts at a literal poorhouse. We meet him at the poorhouse for retired soldiers, and he just wants to have a farm. And I think it's a fascinating exploration of a man driven to have this mission, a man driven to be noble. He aspires to nobility in his actions and the things he's trying to do. And there is something noble about what he's trying to do too, but also this is a movie about him learning like what true nobility actually is. And I think that is fascinating too. Mads Mikkelsen is great. I love everything about this movie, like his mission, the fact that he is kind of an asshole early on, but even his dark heart starts to warm up. I love the variety of characters we have going on here. It is everything I love about Westerns, you know, where you're basically building something in the wild and you've got bandits out there. You've got the sheer elements to fight against. You've got the bureaucracy of a government that is nowhere near where you are, but can basically lay down the law and, like, you know, basically direct how you have to live your life. I think all these things are fascinating. And Mads Mikkelsen is incredible in this film. So yeah, if you miss a good old sweeping Western, this is essentially one of those.
Yeah. I agree with a lot of what you said. And this idea of that, like, other countries have the equivalent of Westerns too, I thought was fascinating to kind of explore.
Well, it's either us or Australia. Australia, we get a lot of it too. Like the entire Mad Max like thing is Australian wilderness. Yeah.
But just this idea, I think that there's this, you know, in America, there's this mythology of this vast untamed land that has yet to be explored, has yet to be settled, has yet to be taken advantage of. And it was just interesting to see that notion in another country's history. Jeff Cannata, what were your thoughts on The Promised Land?
Well, Dave, I guess you could say my thoughts on The Promised Land are best summed up in the form of a limerick.
Interesting.
It's a truly outdated canard that foreign films are avant-garde. This movie's successful and the story's accessible. It's the land and the man that are hard.
Ooh.
Like that. Deep. Yeah. Deep.
It's a hard man in a hard land. There's no harder man than Mads Mikkelsen. As you said, stone-faced, grizzled. I think he smiles once in this movie. And when he does, it's like, whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa, he smiled. I really dug this movie too. It's awesome. I am so taken, and I don't know why, because in real life, this would be the furthest thing that I would want to experience. Like I have no desire at all to be a farmer, to farm. My nightmare is to actually have to farm in any way, in any capacity. And yet I find it so compelling to watch someone work the land, you know? And it's not something you see dramatized very frequently because it's kind of a difficult thing to dramatize. The notion of repetitive daily work, you know? But this movie does a great job in showing just how rough and rugged this heath is, this untamed stretch of unfarmable land, or, you know, purportedly unfarmable. And I'm so taken by how this movie conveys the reality of what that must be like, living by yourself, making everything that you have. You have to make it. You have to conjure it out of nothing. You have to figure out a way to survive in a place that doesn't
want you to. It's inhospitable to your basic needs. And I just, all of that stuff of just being out there and making a life and what is required and the knowledge base that one accumulates over their life that allows them to engage in this endeavor. You know, like he comes to this knowing what needs to happen, how many men he'll need, how many people to work the land with him, what resources it will require, how long it's going to take. All of that just process stuff, I just ate it up. I loved it. And then on top of it, you have this really kind of delicious rivalry with a villain that is great. I mean, it's a great mm-hmm. movie villain, right? A truly despicable movie villain that's brought to life brilliantly by an actor whose name I'm not going to probably be able to pronounce. But just a fantastic experience, start to finish. This hardened world, it really just brings you into the time period in a way that the best movies like this do. You know, I'm thinking of Unforgiven, the old Clint Eastwood movie from the early 90s. Movies that just make you feel lived in, like you understand that the brutality of that life, the harshness of it. The filmmaking does a great job in conveying that and then layering on top what is a very satisfying tale, underdog tale, and, you know, wrapped in virtue and honor and morality. I had a blast with this movie. I'm glad we watched it because it was not on my radar at all. So I enjoyed Promised Land quite a bit.
I also really like this film. I think it's pretty great. I think, it's a lot of plot for even a 2-hour long movie. And I think that certainly towards the last third of the movie, some of the plot developments get a little bit, I'll just say, outlandish, a little bit kind of the first part of the movie, I felt like, oh, this feels like a really grounded, realistic depiction of what it would be like to actually do this. One of the first shots of the movie that immediately I was on board was they show him kind of digging up the land. And then it's not quite a match cut, but it kind of cuts to him doing the same thing in all four seasons. It's like him doing it in the fall, then cut to winter, then spring, then summer, then fall again. And it's like, what an incredible sequence of shots right there. I was like, visually, amazing storytelling going on.
Yeah.
I mentioned Nikolai Arcel directed this. He also directed The Dark Tower, which was not very good. But it's, you know, it was made over at Sony, and I feel pretty confident in saying that it was likely not because of him that the movie was bad.
Lots of reports of studio interference.
Exactly. And so I can imagine he had like a terrible experience making this movie in America, and he went back home and, you know,
to show those Americans how to make a Western, damn it. Yeah.
Well, my sense is that they give people these, you know, $10, $15 million to make a movie, and then that's it. Like, and then you come back with movie, like, so you don't get very much money, but you get like more creative control. And I think that's very evident in this. This feels like really carefully constructed all the way through, very, very meticulously made all the way through. And yeah, I think there's just so many good things about it. Like, you get so attached to these characters. This is one of those movies where it starts getting to the 1 hour, 45 minute mark. And I start getting sad that there's not going to be more movie. Cause I'm like, oh, I feel like there's so much more story left to tell with all these characters. So overall, I had a great time. It's gorgeous. The movie is so beautiful looking. Mads Mikkelsen is a standout. Also, big shout out to the woman who plays one of his workers.
Barbara,
who is...
Amanda Collin is her name.
Amanda Collin, who plays Mother in the HBO Max original series Raised by Wolves.
Right.
She does.
Unrecognizable in this movie compared to that. But
if you know that show and you know what she was in that, like,
it is,
that's pretty rad.
It could not be more different, the kind of role that she plays in this movie. And so she's obviously super talented as well. And yeah, Jeff, you brought up the villain in this movie, who is played by Simon Beniberg, I think, who plays Frederick Dashinkel, and who honestly, that character gives the movie a lot of its comic relief. Like the movie is very sure. serious throughout, but that character is quite funny at times. And
I mean, comically super dark.
Also super dark. Yeah. But there is this, he has this thing where he like tries to add the word duh to his name. So he's like Frederick Dashinkel. And that is it's a very funny ongoing bit that no one respects him in doing that. So anyway, there's a lot of like, just, it's just overall like a really enjoyable epic film with a sweeping scope.
It is
that I would recommend.
Also very I think like it in the second half it tends toward being a romantic film too. Like there's a lot of romanticism here too, which is something I always like in Westerns. Like their love interest shift, you know, but also there's a relationship between him and like a young girl that he ends up adopting, and I thought that was very moving too. Like I think all his relationships with other people are fascinating and astounding, and I found a lot to love with the young girl too. Before we get to spoilers, like I just want to say, like that kid reminded me of my daughter. You know, it's like to bring in a Romani character and to treat her with respect to you, and to show like how those people are, even back then, were especially hated, you know, among the Danish. I think that's tremendous stuff. This movie made me tear up at several times, specifically because of that little girl. So yeah,
I do agree with you a bit, Dave, that the end he turns a little bit into Superman.
Mm-hmm.
Let's
get the spoilers. Yeah. We're going to get the spoilers starting right now.
I thought up an ending for my book.
It makes no damn sense.
Compels me, though.
I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end.
When I buy a new book, I always read the last page first. That way, in case I die before I finish, I know how it ends.
You can't handle the truth.
Inconceivable.
I came here to tell you how it's going to begin.
I think the ending of this movie is wild. Like it gets really kind of soapy pretty quickly towards the end, where she kind of poisons the guy and then cuts his dick off, right?
Yeah.
Like it's really, really like it's very satisfying because that guy is horrible and she's getting her revenge, and you love to see it, but at the same time it felt very like the rest of the movie felt like, oh, this feels very grounded.
Saw a man get boiled alive too, so
yeah, that was pretty
bad.
That was pretty rough. But I don't know, the idea that she could like infiltrate this palace and poison the guy, and then, you know, it felt a little bit far fetched to me.
Yeah. I bought it because also I think a lot of people are like, oh, what are you up to? Oh, you're trying to sneak. Oh, you're trying to do something here. Like I do feel like it would have been pretty easy for her to get back into it. So
the beat that I was like, oh, that's a little shorthand. It's a little hand wavy. Was the very, very end, where it's just like, oh, and also he broke her out of prison and they went off together.
Right.
It's like wait, it. What? He
that's
did
it.
What?
That's all
he
need.
He killed the guy, right? Like driving the prison, because you see a shot of that guy driving the prison carriage, and he seems like he's dead. So he just like goes and murders that guy and then frees
her.
That's
the end
is,
of
like,
that chapter.
It's the happy ending. I mean,
I think it's a good ending in terms of like the arc of his character, right? Of this guy who aspired to nobility at the cost of his human relationships, right?
Yes.
He would rather pretend to be a noble than be kind to other people. And at the end, he figured out what he actually loved. So I think in a poetic form, I think that works.
I agree.
I love the arc.
I just felt it was a little easy. We just see the shackles on the ground. Sure. And it's like, oh.
It's so beautiful, though. So beautiful.
That seems like,
and that answers
right
all
there.
Of my questions about how that
That's all I
out,
need to
right?
know. I've seen what this command can do. Yeah.
Right. But I agree with you, Devendra. I think the arc is really a beautiful one of, here's a guy, he has all these ambitions. We have seen this arc many times before,
but
it's executed so skillfully, right? It's a guy who has all these big dreams, and then realizes like the people that he loves, they're kind of in the way of his big dreams. And so he like sacrifices them to some degree, but then realizes like, hey, that was not a sacrifice worth making. And that's kind
of the people are more important.
Yeah. The people are more important.
The scene where he abandons
the
girl.
What if the real promised land
was
the family and friends we made along the way?
The promised land was the family in that bed together. Like that one sweet scene where they're all hanging out together. And like the scene where
smiling.
He has to abandon the girl just broke my heart. And then he goes back and finds her and he's like, the biggest apology of all time. Like, I will never let you down again.
Yeah.
You know, like that all killed me. Yeah.
I know.
Yeah.
That scene where he abandons her and she's calling Papa and he's just won't look back. Ugh.
Ugh.
Yeah. And at the same time, I think to the film's credit, it lets you understand what a challenging position he's in, right? Like, mm-hmm. if he doesn't do what these settlers say, he's his whole life, like everything in his life that he's been building up to is lost, essentially. And it's like an impossible position for him, and he chooses poorly in that case. But yeah, I mean, there are so many little touches about the movie I loved. Like, first of all, I think with one exception, it does a pretty good job of showing you what frontier living is like. So, like,
mm-hmm. yeah,
I think the house looks a little bit too nice. Like, just building that house in the middle of nowhere is like, wow, that's a massive accomplishment.
I wish they hadn't skipped over that. I would love to have seen, like, that house erected. Like,
that's amazing.
Right.
But then, you know, throughout the movie, DeShinkel continues to offer him outs. And there's this one scene where he gives him, like, this bucket of slop that's, like, left over. And then, like, they eat it because they're so hungry. I was like, I've never seen anything like that. Where, like, yes, the leftovers from this guy's palace or whatever would, of course, be, like, really nourishing to, you know. But it like, looks very unpleasant. And then later when the bag of gold is in it, it's such a badass, like,
well, he doesn't, I don't even think he's eating it by that point. He's sitting there looking at everybody eating. And he's like, this cannot stand. Like, I'm not going to stand for this. Like, he's a man of principles, you know, and that's ultimately, like, part of the problem for him. But the result is we're gonna have to kill the last goat, the only goat we have. We have packs and packs of, you know, bags of potatoes. We're going to kill this goat because they need the food, and also this little girl's going to die if I don't do it.
And so, he doesn't want to sacrifice his potatoes. Guys, this movie should have potatoes. Been called There Will Be Spud.
Well done.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you.
Well done.
Anyway, any other
just
thoughts?
Sitting on that one the whole time? You're just sitting on that?
That should have been your opening.
That should have been your opening well, statement on the show. Think
it's quasi spoiler that, like, but it's like funny the way potatoes are in this movie. It's like,
I didn't mention potatoes.
Potatoes, like, this is the, you know, this is the magic potatoes food. Potatoes are wild. It can grow in any circumstance.
Well, thing that was so funny to me about that is everybody knew about it. I'm like, why didn't we all just go get potatoes?
Well, potatoes were hard to get. I got to look up the exact time frame, but potatoes were not widespread everywhere, right? They came from the Americas.
From Germany.
Like,
Germany. And
initially.
Do you think these potatoes grow on trees, Jeff? Come on,
potatoes came from the Americas. So even back then, potatoes as a thing were new to a lot of countries. So, yeah.
I just felt like in the palace, they're like, he's like, he's not going to be able to grow anything. It's like, oh, he's got potatoes. And like, oh, potatoes.
Never thought of that.
it's like, well, why don't you go get some potatoes, dude? You got money? Like,
yeah, it's like he has like a nuclear weapon. We are screwed now.
Well, when DeShinkel hears about the potatoes, they're like, oh, hell.
Yeah.
That's, can't beat this. But part of it, too, is like all the royal advisors also just don't give a shit. Like, they don't actually care about doing the thing in the heath. They just want to appease the king, you know? So, like, this is somebody who actually cares about doing this work. And that's the sort of that dichotomy we see early on, too, where they're making fun of his outfit and they're just like lazy and eating. Mm-hmm. And he's just like, I have this plan. I'm going to do this. Is there a more noble actor out there now than Mads Mikkelsen? Because man, this guy will just like in a dumpy, flea-ridden costume, like will project the most nobility in that room.
Yeah. I love how everyone's like, you know, you're wearing a really shitty flea-ridden outfit. I'm like, he looks pretty freaking
looks
pretty
good. Badass to me.
I was like, he looks pretty freaking sweet. Well, I don't think I could pull that off.
The wig did look shitty. The wig looked bad, but
the whole him standing there for the wig replacement thing, like, I feel like he would not stand for that.
Real power move. Real power move.
Very funny when he puts it on and that white wig just looks like ass on his head, you know, and he's like, he walks up to the girl and he's like, hello. And she's like, oh, geez.
Yeah.
Very funny. I also loved how he's got all this confidence in the king, and the king is a complete drunk, like, doesn't know anything that's going on. The guys are like, we don't care about this dude. The king doesn't know anybody from anything.
I just think when you read, when you're reading history books, it's like, the king did this and the king did that. And then you watch a movie like this and it's like, oh, that guy is like hundreds of miles away. There's no like police or phones or anything. Right. Everyone's just on their own. Like, there's no law. Like, everyone just does what they, you know, defends themselves. And it's like, this movie really kind of shows you how tenuous that power is.
The richest person is the law, basically. So,
what did they have to do? Like, if you are infinitely wealthy and powerful, what do you have to do in that world? There's nothing to do. There's no way to entertain yourself. You hunt. Okay. Yeah. They go on a hunt, a farce of a hunt, or they get wasted every day. Like that's,
yeah,
that's the two activities, I guess.
Well, the other activity is acquiring more land and more power, you know? So
there was no Netflix back then. There was no Max the One to watch for HBO.
No,
you
know? They didn't have anything to watch for HBO. There was no one to watch.
Would have been a whole different world. I bet Dashinkle would not have given him such a hard time.
Yeah.
If he had,
if that dude, if that
he could watch Love is Blind season four.
If he could have binged True Detective, that dude would have been a complete non-issue.
All right. Anyway, this is a movie we all really enjoyed. Well worth watching. An epic story, an epic love story. You should check it out. It is The Promised Land.
Good.
It's available right now in streaming or video on demand. And at the end of the day, it is really impressive that Nikolai Arcel made The Dark Tower and then still kept making movies and made The Promised Land.
Well, got the hell out of the U.S.
Because this movie
better movies.
Rocks.
Yeah.
All right. That's going to bring us to the end of today's episode of The Filmcast. You can find more episodes of this podcast at thefilmcast.com. Email us at /filmcast@gmail.com. Our theme song comes from Tim McCune from The Midnight. Our spoiler bumper comes from Noah Ross. As well as our weekly plugs music, Noah Ross also helped to edit this episode with video assistance provided by Kurt Mega. Patreon.com/filmpodcast, how you can support the show. Next week on the podcast, it's going to be Love Lies Bleeding, I believe. It's going to be the main review for next week. Should be a lot of fun. Thank you so much for listening. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you all later. Goodbye.